You're listening to Talk of the Rock, and we have a busy schedule today. We're starting with Hope Resources. They are doing a upcoming event, and then we have a doctor who went to South Sudan to volunteer there, and then we have a discussion with a poet who's dropping by next week. Her name is Joan Kane. And so let's start with Corey Davis from Hope. Why don't you introduce yourself and what you do with the organization?
All right. Hi, everyone. My name is Corey Davis. I am the director here in Kodiak, so I oversee the Kodiak Network and the Aleutian Chain. And as was mentioned before, Hope has a fundraiser coming up. It's actually our largest annual fundraiser. We've been doing this for 49 years now. It's called our Walk and Roll for Hope. Not everyone can use their feet to get around. Some of us need to roll. So we don't just walk, we roll. And actually, it's a pretty fun fundraiser. When it started in Anchorage back 49 years ago, it was a 31-mile walk. We are not doing that in Kodiak. The weather doesn't permit 31 miles of anything. So instead, we are going to be meeting at Baranoff Track on Saturday, May 5th. Registration is at 9:30. The walk starts at 10. We're going to walk around the track, and DJ Mark's going to be playing us some lively tunes, so it's a great time to hang out, bring your family, enjoy the music, get in a good exercise, and we'll have punch cards. So you fill up your punch card, you get entered in a drawing to win a Walmart gift card. The registration fee is $15. If you can raise $75 in pledges, you can get a free T-shirt. So lots of fun things. If you participate in the walk afterwards, you are more than welcome to join us for a barbecue at our 917 Mill Bay location. Just another time to hang out and have lunch with friends.
Okay, so this is to fundraise for Hope, right?
It is, yes.
Okay.
So Hope Community Resources provides supports to people who experience developmental and intellectual disabilities. So we have a whole range of supports that we provide here in Kodiak. We have three assisted living homes. We do supported employment. We operate a children's after-school program and an adult recreation program, and some respite services as well to kind of give families a break.
And I know for the past couple of years, Hope has been having some funding issues like a lot of different nonprofits around town. Could you explain that situation as it currently stands?
Sure. So that's absolutely correct. Like all nonprofits, we are taking a hit. We've had a very substantial grant over the past quite a few decades, probably, that has funded our children's and adult recreation program. It was cut by 75% this last fiscal year, and it will be cut completely FY 2019. So really trying to find different funding sources for those two programs that are very, very needed. And the money's ways to the walk and roll stay in Kodiak. They don't go to Anchorage or anywhere else across the state. So those monies will be used to provide respite services for some of those families that are currently receiving respite through the programs that won't be funded anymore.
What is the customer base number so far? How many community members do you guys reach out to?
So currently we have 50 families that we support. And I say families because a person who experiences a disability lives within a family and within a community. And their disability affects all the people that love and care about them. So we currently support 50. We are always looking for more, for new people to come in. Our doors are wide open. Besides the 50 families that we support, we also have 41 employees here in Kodiak. So it's a good number of people that are involved with Hope.
Could you talk to me a little bit about how you joined the organization and got involved?
Sure. I joined Hope 6 years ago as a direct support provider. I was actually a school teacher and wanted some summer income. So I did direct supports and worked with mostly kids who experienced autism. And then 4 years ago, the director position opened up, so I applied and have been doing that for the last 4 years.
What kind of effect do you see Hope making in the community and for the families it helps out?
So I've heard from some of the families that if it wasn't for Hope, that they wouldn't be able to stay in Kodiak, that they wouldn't be able to stay together as a family because they couldn't take care of their loved one on their own, and they really need professional help to come in and help when they've got to go to work or just to help teach their family members something that they can't. And so for a lot of families, it means that they get to stay together and they get to stay in their home community.
Okay. And so when is the event again?
Saturday, May 5th. That's coming up here just about 2 weeks. So registration starts at 9:30. And then the walk itself starts at 10. And we have community involvement already. We're super happy. The Key Club and the SCA are joining us. They're going to be volunteering there, helping us get set up, helping with the barbecue. But we'd love to see more community members come out and join us.
Is there a goal for an amount you want to work up to, or are you just hoping to earn whatever that you can?
I don't like to put goal amounts. That kind of limits us. So you know, we lost a substantial amount of funding from the state this year. So anything that we can bring in is going to really make a big difference.
Where are you receiving the bulk of your funds nowadays?
Bulk of our funds are Medicaid. But things like respite care, respite for families that don't receive Medicaid for one reason or another, that's all funded through this grant from the state or from city and borough grants or whatever other small grants that we can get.
Okay. So, Corey, I know you have an appointment coming up, so we're going to let you go and transition over to you, sir. Why don't you introduce yourself?
So my name's David Silbergeld. I'm a family doc at Kodiak Community Health Center, and I'm here to in part talk about a little work that I was doing recently in South Sudan and that I'm hoping to do continually in the future.
All right. Before we continue on to that, what is your background? Where do you come from?
So I've been all over the place. I'm originally from Seattle, Washington, and I lived on the East Coast for a while where I did medical school. But I've been in Alaska now for the past 4 years and just moved here about 10 months ago.
From where?
Previously in Anchorage.
Okay. So what is it that appeals to you about living on this island?
So Kodiak for a family med doc is kind of the ideal place because you get to do a wide variety of services in your practice. Here I'm able to do both outpatient and inpatient work as well as obstetrics. And the broad spectrum care that family med docs used to do is no longer available in nearly as many places as it used to be. And here's one of those few places that you can still do everything that family docs used to do.
And so you volunteered in South Sudan. Could you talk a little bit about how you ended up doing that?
So there's a doctor out in Bethel who has had a long-standing relationship with South Sudan, actually, since far before it became a country in 2011. Her name's Dr. Jill Seaman, and she's been going to South Sudan area now for about 32 years, I believe it is. So she has, in the past, just been going on her own, but about 8 years, Dr. Jack Hickel, who's a family physician in Anchorage, actually sort of helped further establish several different programs that are now run under her auspices. And she goes back there. She spends about 6 to 7 months out of the year there, and she is always actively trying to recruit doctors from around Alaska and elsewhere to join her and help out.
What kind of work did you do there?
So it's a wide variety of work. For the most part, what we're doing as a project is medical work. So we're working sort of parallel to Doctors Without Borders, which operates a site out there. But we're often dealing with some of the more complex patients who have a variety of tropical diseases, including leishmaniasis, tuberculosis, HIV and AIDS, and some things like that. And we're both operating an outpatient clinic that's run by community health workers when none of the docs are there, as well as doing inpatient management for some of the more complex patients there.
So was there one of those conditions that you saw most often?
That's a good question. I think it's a decent mix, and it can vary a lot from time to time. When I was there, this was actually not a bad year for leishmaniasis, which is locally called Kala Azar. We saw a fair amount of TB while I was there, which typically has relatively stable rates. But there are some times where the Kala Azar leishmaniasis is far, far more prevalent, depending on what the season has been like in terms of moisture and mosquitoes previously. So it can vary a lot from one season and one year to the next.
So what do you tell people when they come in? Is there a set number of things you would tell them or questions you would ask them?
Really, we operate pretty much as a normal clinic out there. So we're seeing lots of patients also for basic things that happen here, like acid reflux as well. normal infectious and non-infectious diarrhea and other things like that. So we're pretty much operating the same way that I would here, except with a very different set of diseases that we're watching out for and potentially treating in more sick patients.
When did you go over there?
So I was there for about 3 weeks from late January through mid-February.
Okay. Was it warm?
Almost every day while I was there was above 100 degrees.
Wow.
When I got there is sort of the transition from when it's relatively temperate in the high 80s to mid 90s to when it's consistently hot in the 100 degree range.
Oh, wow. Temperate mid 90s, huh? That's great.
Mm-hmm.
How long did you spend there?
So I was there for about 3 weeks this time, and generally when doctors go along with Dr. Seaman, usually they're there for about 3 to 4 weeks. Sometimes it can vary based on when we're able to get flights in and out, however.
Okay, and so how was the conditions where you were living? Was it, where did you room? What was the arrangements?
So at this site, we actually stay in tents. There is a building that was built many years ago for the program that is quite infested with bats and some other rodents. So we use that for a place to prepare meals and to eat those meals. But otherwise, in terms of where we're actually sleeping, it's in tents outside in a fenced off courtyard.
Okay, so it sounds rural, was it?
It's quite rural. It's an area. So the town is called Old Fangak, and it's a town that a mere 5 years ago had about 5,000 people, but because of internally displaced people, it's ballooned to almost 50,000 people.
Okay, and so what's the population like? Is it a high level of education? Is it lower, or what's the most common?
So the vast majority of the people there are very minimally educated. In this province, probably now the best school is actually located in the town, which is in large part due to help with some religious agencies, as well as simply the fact that so many internally displaced people have moved there over the last few years. But that school nonetheless is teaching most of its students on what we would consider an elementary school level. So education there is absolutely a luxury. It's not something that a lot of people have. And I think the select few people who are relatively well educated, many of them are people who actually had left South Sudan as refugees and lived sometime in Uganda, Kenya, or other places like that.
What did you see of the political situation?
It's always hard for me to talk politics about there because it's a new government and it's somewhat tenuously formed. There are constant changes, and just like the rest of the country, the government is financially, to a certain extent, in shambles. So even government employees are often not well paid and may not even have enough money for food a week or two down the line. Beyond that, it's sort of difficult for me to talk politics about South Sudan because it's such a different and wild place, and there's no real comparison to what politics is here in a very high-functioning political society.
So you said you guys were working parallel with Doctors Without Borders. How many people did you have in your crew?
So our group, when I was there, there were myself and two other doctors with us. There are two sort of parallel groups, one of which is a medical group that Dr. Seaman really runs, and the other of which is actually more of a infrastructure project that the day that I left, someone from that project was scheduled to arrive. But while I was there, it was just three of us working on the medical project. So that usually ranges from one to two people on the medical side and maybe having two or three people with the infrastructure side.
And were you all Alaskans?
So no, actually, Dr. Seaman and I are from Alaska. One of the other doctors was from Idaho. And actually, I should correct myself. There was a pharmacist there also on the medical side who is from the Netherlands.
And did you guys have equipment, up-to-date equipment that you could use and all the resources that you needed?
Unfortunately, no, and the reality is we probably won't for a very long time there. That's one of the limitations of working in a place like that is we have a variety of very basic things like a meter to check creatinine and a meter to check blood sugars. We have some hand tools and all of that, but in terms of getting any more extensive services, such as getting an X-ray or anything like that, all of those people have to be sent out of country, in fact.
How close were you to a hospital?
So technically, the area that we operate in, the Doctors Without Borders Center is sort of considered a hospital, but it's a hospital that operates out of tents rather than any formal standing structure. They're working actually on building a new building that is probably near completion that's going to operate as a standing metal structure for a hospital. But otherwise, you really have to fly out about 200 plus miles to the capital of Juba to get to any real hospital, and even the care that you can get there is relatively minimal.
So what was your schedule like every day? What kind of, did you have many patients coming to see you?
Yeah, so every day, the schedule varies a little bit, but pretty much every day, we're rounding on our inpatients in the morning, and we do that as long as it takes to see all of the patients who are hospitalized under our services. And then afternoon, for however long it takes, we're seeing patients in our clinic. The reality is that the schedule also depends on taking care of all of the other needs that a lot of the local people have, simply because people rely on Dr. Seaman and this project for basic necessities like food and soap. And oftentimes she or one of us are drawn away from clinic or other responsibilities to help provide services like that or get people certain things that they otherwise have no access to.
So when are you headed back?
Hopefully I'm going to be going back next, this coming October. She typically arranges her schedule during the summer, and I'm hoping to be going back at least once to twice each year if the situation works out.
All right. Have you ever volunteered elsewhere? What other kind of things have you gotten involved in?
So I've done a little international work otherwise. I spent a little time working in the Northern Himalayas in India back when I was in medical school. And then also as part of my master's in public health training, I actually did a little work in the Dominican Republic a few years ago. But that's about it prior to this. And this is a far cry from the experiences of those two places.
Sounds like you're attracted to very hot places.
Northern Himalayas, not so much. Even during the summer, it was getting down to freezing at night. But it seems that is the case, that often I end up in hot places, yes.
How was the Dominican Republic?
Dominican Republic was amazing. We were working largely with Haitian population there, which there's a very tenuous political situation that I can't say has changed much in a number of years. But there's a lot of hostility from the government, especially towards Haitian people in the Dominican Republic. So we were working, when I was there, with an orphanage. And oftentimes these are people whose family members had been deported or have come and crossed the border multiple times. Or many people whose family members have simply been lost due to the worst political situation in Haiti relative to the Dominican Republic.
What did you do with that population?
So to a certain extent, because I was already in my medical training at that time, I was helping with clinical side and evaluating patients. But also we were doing a lot of basic public health things, such as providing deworming medications and just basic education on how to avoid worms, on how to eat more healthy. Really basic things like that, to be honest.
How does one avoid worms?
So in the Dominican Republic, most of the worms that people get are sandworms that enter through their feet and come from dog or cat feces. So really just avoiding walking on the beaches or in sandy areas barefoot is one of the most important things, actually. It's simple, but it's one of those things that you'd never know to do if you weren't educated about it.
Is it doable?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so are there any other areas of the world that you want to volunteer in besides the ones that you've dropped by?
I'm never sure about that. I really, one of the things about family medicine that's very important to me is having some degree of continuity with your patients. And I think there's a lot of benefit in doing what Dr. Seaman does and going back to the same place where she's really built a reputation for herself, both in that community and around the country. And I'd like to be able to do something like that, where I'm going back and working with some of the same patients and in the same community. I have backgrounds in traveling to experiencing and learning the languages of some other cultures. I was a Chinese major and undergraduate, actually, but I think that at least for now and the near future, South Sudan is hopefully going to be the place that I continue to go back to more stably.
Did you communicate in the language in South Sudan?
To a very limited extent. This is my first time going there, and most of the people speak Nuer. English used to be... English is really an official language, but most people don't speak it simply due to the limitations in education. So we actually had translators, many of whom had studied in Uganda or in Kenya, who helped us significantly in terms of being able to speak with patients.
And you did learn a little bit.
A few words here and there, but unfortunately not as much as I'd like to know. And hopefully in the future I'll learn a lot more.
Can you share some?
So I guess just basic greetings. People greet each other by saying male or male maguar is one of the common ways of greeting each other. There are a variety of ways to vary that in terms of how you greet each other that basically are, I forget exactly the translation to tell you the truth. Basically saying peace is good or peace is great are common forms of greeting there. So male maguar translates to peace is good.
Did you learn any of the language in Haiti?
Unfortunately, no. I speak a little bit of French. I don't speak very much Spanish. A few medical terms that I've picked up over the years in training simply because you have to in America as well. But... not enough to really communicate to any significant extent.
Okay. Do you have a specialty? You said you were in family med.
Yeah, so I'm a family med doctor here, which generally translates to outpatient medicine in America. But again, as I mentioned earlier, here that often has a lot of overlap with doing obstetrical care, doing pediatric care. I don't personally, but some of our doctors also do emergency care also here. So.
Okay. So we had planned to talk with Joan Kane, who's a poet who's coming to visit. She's unable to be a guest. She just let us know via text. But we have someone who can talk about the events here.
Sure. Hi, my name is Jordana Long. I am the English department chair at Kodiak College. And I'm also on the Kodiak College Community Engagement Committee, which is hosting Joan Kane over the weekend. Joan, do you want me to talk a little bit about her bio and so forth?
Sure. Failing having her here, you might
all
as
right.
well introduce her.
I'm not going to be as awesome as Joan herself, but Joan Kane is an Alaska Native poet. Her family comes from Kings Island and Mary's Igloo. She studied at Harvard College and got her MFA at Columbia University's School of the Arts, and she is the recipient of multiple awards and fellowships, most recently the Guggenheim Fellowship. So we are very honored and excited to have her coming down to Kodiak this weekend.
All right, and what's her schedule like?
It's busy. Joan was really excited to come to Kodiak and asked us to basically pack her schedule full of a lot of outreach and events. She's going to be starting out on Friday with the public. Well, it's going to be open to the various middle schoolers of the community at the college. And then she's going to be spending the early afternoon at the high school visiting various English classes. And then this is a public children's event that's going to be at the Kodiak Public Library on Friday, April 20th from 3:30 to 4:30. It's called Poetry and Youth. And so bring your youth out to visit with a poet. And then in the evening on Friday, we're going to have an evening with Joan Kane, which will be a public poetry reading and discussion at Kodiak College from 6 to 7:30 that evening. And then Saturday, she's going to be hosting a Sense of Place beach walk at Buskin Beach. All are welcome, even dogs, from 11 to 12. That would be Saturday, April 21st. And then in the evening on Saturday, come on out to the brewery to meet and greet a Guggenheim poet. You can come and visit with Joan, hang out, have some delicious drinks. This will be 6 to 7 p.m. on Saturday. And then she's going to be wrapping things up on Sunday from 2 to 3:30 on Sunday, April 22nd. We'll be having another event at the Kodiak Public Library, which is open to the public, Tea and Poetry with Joan Kane. So come on out. Please join us for these events. This is a very spectacular experience that we're going to have with Joan.
All right. And so you're with the English department?
Yes.
Right? Can you tell us what's happening with Kodiak College and that department right now?
So Kodiak College is, you know, it's a community campus of the University of Alaska Anchorage. So really, more largely, the things that are happening at UAA and the larger UA system are what is affecting Kodiak College. It's interesting, you know, in thinking about having Joan come down, one of the conversations we've been having in the UAA English department most recently is as we're updating curriculum and course content guides and so forth, you know, particularly with the broad literature courses like Introduction to Literature and Masterpieces of World Literature, which are classes I teach, how do we see, you know, what is a masterpiece? You know, what's part of the quote unquote literary canon? And so it's an ongoing conversation that we have about, particularly given our placement in Alaska, what makes our masterpieces unique? And we're trying to broaden our focus to really include the literature of the circumpolar north and particularly Native voices and the Native Alaska Native experience. So, again, it's really exciting that we have an Alaska Native poet who's going to be joining us and can kind of speak into this with her work.
Do you guys plan to bring any more poets in the future?
Honestly, well, I mean, we've had some really fantastic writers come down in the past. We had Heather Lind come down a couple years ago. We have a local writer, Sarah Lowen, who has done presentations, and she's a fantastic essayist, nonfiction writer. We are always excited to have, you know, our Alaska writers come and do events at the college. This is our, you know, the one we have scheduled for now, but if you're an Alaska writer and you want to do an event at the college, please feel free to contact us too.
Okay. So are there any other exciting events that we should have on our radar?
Well, you know, we are always, as you know, as a community, we want to, as a college community, we want to engage with the larger Kodiak community as much as possible. So while the Community Engagement Committee doesn't exactly have anything official planned, we are reaching out to various writers, travelers, and so forth, and we do plan to host further events, probably not this spring, but starting up again in the fall.
Okay, and what's the first event that you can see Joan at?
Oh, yes. The first one that's open to the public is the children's event at the library, 3:30 on Friday. And then please come out to the college at 6 p.m. on Friday for her public poetry reading and discussion.
Okay. Thank you guys so much for coming on to the show today. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks.